free and happy life. The children said their dream is to fly in the sky without any restrictions or wars. A herd of wild Asian elephants in China has turned into international stars after leaving their natural habitat in Yunnan province. The herd of 15 elephants is said to have left home in southwest China 15 months ago, but it was in April when they grabbed officials' attention after they were spotted by locals. The elephants have so far trekked nearly 500 kilometers across the country. They have traveled through villages and towns and even stopped for a rest. Local authorities have welcomed these mammoth travelers with treats of sweet corn and bananas. They are monitoring the elephants' movements with drones while keeping them away from residential areas.
Chinese grandma has given a dazzling display of her masterly kung fu performance at a martial arts competition. The 98-year-old woman and her son took the stage as a curtain raiser to the event. The duo put on a kung fu show before a large crowd of spectators who were impressed by her skillful gestures. She was invited to the competition to act as a judge.
I started practicing martial arts when I was only 5. I would box every day, learning movements like chopping, pushing palm, and thrusting palm. Though I am old now, my strength hasn't gone.
Zhang says she's inherited her family's martial arts. She's rumored to have a sense of justice from a very young age and try to help others, which earned her quite a reputation where she lives. Traditional martial arts have been passed down in the Zhongking village located in Zhejiang province for 500 years. Go to Italy, where Mount Etna has put on an eye-catching show with its spectacular eruptions. Red-hot lava fountains and plumes of smoke spewed up into the sky. The main eruption was located at the southeastern crater of the volcano. Mount Etna is Europe's tallest active volcano. It's located above the Sicilian town of Catania. It often erupts but rarely causes damage. However, nearby residents have to deal with ash showers. Geological studies show that Mount Etna has been active for more than 2 million years now. Egypt has opened its first archaeological replica factory in an attempt to promote its culture worldwide. The factory was inaugurated in response to people's demand for having detailed copies of ancient treasures. So far, over 6,400 high-quality replicas of ancient Egyptian artifacts have been produced. More than 150 artists work to make the goods out of stone, wood, and even gold.
The materials with which these are made are high quality. The highest and most elegant materials are being used to make these samples, and the materials are very close to those used to make the original artifacts.
The models have certificates showing that they are identical copies of the original artifacts. Each replica also has a barcode that provides extra information about the item. The factory is located in Qayyubah, about 35 kilometers northeast of the capital, Cairo.
Now, a lot of people don't like rats and find them disgusting most of the time. However, the rodents are doing life-saving work in Cambodia. Now, the Southeast Asian nation has deployed a new squad of African giant pouched rats to sniff out old landmines. The new recruits have shown an exceptional ability at their task, with their handlers claiming 100% accuracy. There are now nearly 50 demining rats working in the field in Cambodia. The country started using the animal services in 2016, and they have helped detect and clear hundreds of landmines since. Last year, an especially heroic rat called Magawa attracted global fame after receiving a gold medal for his work. The hero rat, who is now retired, detected over 71 landmines.
A muralist from Greece is blending mythology with graffiti and street art to depict how COVID-19 has impacted lives around the globe. Ficus Antonios has painted the walls of many cities around the globe. He is now in the Cypriot capital, Nicosia, to continue his work. His latest artwork depicts Americus, a Cypriot mythical figure who was punished by the gods and turned into a plant. The Greek artist believes this theme is similar to the situation people around the globe have experienced since the pandemic began. He explains many people have grown roots because they're staying in one place for so long. Two British artists have brought a combination of fun art and environmental concerns to the sidelines of the G7 summit. They have created a modern-day version of famous sculpture carved into America's Mount Rushmore. This time, it's called Mount Recyclemore. Joe Rush and Alex Rackage have made a sculpture of G7 leaders with electronic waste. They say their major goal is to raise awareness about the amount of unrecycled tech and gadgets, the damage they cause to the environment, and the ways to combat the issue internationally.
Well, what I'd like them to do, the leaders of the G7 conference, is I'd like them all to talk to each other and work out a plan that isn't just shifting the problem from one country to another, you know, but actually is a plan that we all work on together, which is how to deal with this waste and how to stop producing so much waste and how to recycle things. And all these issues have got to be dealt with globally. They can't be dealt with nationally because that's where the problem is. So we need them all to get together, like we've put them together here, and deal with the problem.
The United Nations says 53 million tons of electronic waste are generated annually all over the world. It estimates that the amount of the waste will double in less than 30 years. If that happens, electronic waste would become the fastest growing waste stream in the world. Advanced robots are increasingly helping humans in a variety of innovative ways. Now they have found a place in the healthcare system and will help nurses and doctors stay safe during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I can do all kinds of things for elderly people. I can visit with people and brighten their day with social stimulation, entertain and help guide exercise, but also can do talk therapy, take bio readings and help healthcare providers assess their health and deliver treatments.
Grace, which is the newest humanoid robot to join the healthcare fleet. This intelligent machine can take temperatures and record other vital signs of patients. It has been designed in a way to also interact with the elderly and those isolated by the pandemic. Grace is a new prototype of celebrity humanoid robot, Sophia, created by a robotic team in Hong Kong.
So we designed Grace to look professional in a healthcare setting. So that would mean so that she would resemble the sort of human-like appearance of healthcare staff. And so then this would facilitate more natural interactions. A human-like appearance facilitates trust and facilitates a natural engagement because we're wired for human face-to-face interactions. That's just the way human beings are.
Hansen, while standing between Sophia and Grace, also said that both robots could speak different languages. He said Grace's creation was aimed at relieving the burden of frontline hospital staff dealing with COVID-19 patients. The company is planning a mass production of Grace and offers them to the market by August. The cost of making this robot is similar to a luxury car, but the cost is likely to decrease once the company begins manufacturing it in its thousands.
The light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A tiny worm has wriggled back to life after lying frozen for 24,000 years in the permafrost land of northern Siberia. The organism was recovered from soil samples taken from 3.5 meters below the ground in Russia's Yakutia region. It's a multicellular organism that can withstand extreme cold. This ancient worm has broken the record for the longest living abedloid rotifer worm. Previous research suggests that it could survive for a decade when frozen. Earlier, scientists also discovered 30,000-year-old microscopic worms from northern Siberia. Australian scientists have discovered one of the world's largest ever dinosaur species in the Erromanga area in outback Queensland. Research shows the plant-eating sauropod lived between 92 million and 96 million years ago when Australia was attached to Antarctica. Paleontologists estimated the dinosaur was as long as a basketball court and as tall as a two-story building. That makes it the largest dinosaur ever found in Australia and one of the top five largest ones in the world. Bones of the dinosaur were first uncovered more than a decade ago by cattle farmers. Iranian capital Tehran has hosted a festival of cake sculptors. The event showcases delicious sweets that are carved into eye-catching sculptures. Yusuf Jalali has more.
It's not a piece of cake to bake a sculpture, but pastry chefs here have made it. In the fourth festival of cake sculptures in Iran, sugarcraft artists from across the country have come under one roof in Tehran to cast their spell on these sweets and carve a wide range of fascinating 3D figures out of them. From this tasty coronavirus to this beautiful angel that is picking up the only eatable trash in the world.
Here you can see this angel, which represents the innocent heart of labor children, collecting pieces of trash that contain some of the simplest dreams of a labor child, such as quality food, books, and toys.
My cake is made based on what we call installation art. I have put together iconic structures and monuments of Iran. But when you take a look at them from a special angle, you can see Iran's map.
Some of the cake sculptures here have really pushed the envelope of the art of sculpting. Like this bust that shows the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, surrounded with a heavenly garden that's decorated with intricate and mind-boggling details. It took its creator almost a month to finish it.
In the middle, I have put the bust of Rumi, who we refer to as Maulana in Iran. He's holding his most significant verse work, Masnavi Manavi. The garden I created around him and the birds here all are inspired by his poems.
Organizers say they hold the festival every year to modernize the confectionery industry and combine it with fine arts to make it more appealing to the public.
500 works are showcased here in four sections. Bust cakes, wedding cakes, cookie cakes, which are made using royal icing, and the fourth section is cream cakes. The major goal is to scout for talents who can revolutionize the confectionery industry.
Some of the participants in the festival are pastry chefs who try to make their cakes look better, and others are actually pro sculptors who want to bake a figure instead of carving it. Perhaps it's easy to tell who is who by taking a glimpse at their cakes. But sweets will win the competition. They're both delicious and delicate.
It takes ultimate care and a knack for both bakery and artistry to be able to transform sweets into statues. In fact, they're both so spectacular and yummy that make you want to have the cake and eat it too. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. The Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wook is a 28-year-old industrial engineer or designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Pang says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see their third eye.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إذا أضرت النوافل بالفرائض فارفضوها.
Imam Ali said, when optional issues
the nawafil stand in the way of the wajib, the fara'id, then abandon the nawafil. Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Yes, dear friends, one of the great lessons which we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam, the first divinely appointed Imam, is that we need to make sure the one who has the most faith is the one who judges and issues decrees among us, not necessarily the one who has more money or a greater social status. Khawarizmi says that one day two men came to the second caliph, Umar, and asked him about the divorce of a female slave. Now turning to a group of people with a man who was bald in the front part of his head, the caliph Umar says, "What is your judgment on this issue?" The man, who was apparently bald in the front part of his head, says, "You should keep two idda, the periods during which a divorced or a widowed woman may not be married to another man." And so he says that she should keep two idda, whereas a free woman should keep three idda. So the second caliph Umar says, "Two idda," as the man who had just said in the gathering. Then addressing the second caliph Umar, one of the two men says, "You are supposed to be the Amir al-Mu'mineen and the caliph. We came here to pose our question to you, O Caliph Umar, but you are asking others for the answers. By Allah, he did not speak to you, but he gave you a clear sign, that man over there." The Caliph Umar says, "Woe to you! Do you know who this man is who gave me the signal and the answer? He is Ali ibn Abi Talib. And I myself heard the Messenger of Allah saying, if the heavens and the earth are put on a pan of a scale, and Ali's faith is placed on the other, surely Ali's faith will be heavier." A beautiful lesson, dear friends. Those who have more wealth, or who have social status, or who have power, or who have influence, should not be the ones to make judgment among the people, but rather faith and knowledge is what is necessary. Brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالمون يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the producer of the program To My Brother, and at this moment I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Fayyaz Jafar. I hope you enjoy it.
In terms of understanding then, what exactly did the Imam alayhi salatu wasalam say toward Malik al-Ashtar in terms of taking over the importance of this position as the governor of Egypt? We have to understand that the Imam and all of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, they set down very unique guidelines, first of all, in regards toward people who took positions of leadership. You go toward Imam Zainul Abidin, alayhi as-salam, he has what is known as the rights of the leader. When you go toward a letter by Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ruba, alayhi as-salam, he writes a letter toward Harun al-Rashid, in which he advises him about what it means toward being a leader. When you go toward the advices of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the day of Ashura that he uttered toward the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, he explained toward them the role and the responsibilities of taking positions of leadership. But again, nothing is perhaps more eloquent than these words of the commander of the faithful toward Malik al-Ashtar. And he tries to advise his companion, and in reality, we can take lessons from every single one of his advices in terms of how he should be amongst those who win the hearts of the people. What makes the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, what made Ahlul Bayt alayhi wa salatu wa salam so lovable? What made these individuals so polarizing that everyone looked toward them, wanted to spend time with them? Is because they were human beings. They didn't demonstrate themselves with this garb of superiority when they walked with people. They were the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, my friends. They were the owners of the universe. Yet they still would hang out, they would eat, they would talk, they would make jokes. When people would come from Kufa toward visiting Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, the Imam would make jokes, he would converse, he would be sarcastic with them. The first conversations that he would have with them is, you know, how's it going? What type of work do you do? When the guy would say, I'm a fruit vendor, he would tell them, and what's the cost of peaches and what's the cost of oranges? He would make small talk with people. He was someone who opened up his heart. The Imams of Ahlul Bayt opened up their heart in order to create an access point, an entry point for everyone around them to engage with.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
that permission, Shahid said, after praising Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he says that our respectable son, Hujjatul Islam wal Muslimin, Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi, has spent a long time of his life learning fiqh, usul, and theological studies, so that he has succeeded to become a mujtahid on whom Islam and the Muslims may rely.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was living in Najaf. This was because, I mean, the ex-Baathist regime hadn't devastated the whole Najaf seminary. And another one is that Najaf was in some way the hub of all the Shiite world.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding jurists, philosophers, and thinkers of the Nation of Islam all across the world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor.
Assalamu alaikum.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naghwi, an Islamic scholar from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So today we want to continue our discussion regarding the character of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Hashimi Shahrudi. In our previous discussions, we talked about his lineage, his background, and his scholarly and academic, you know, character, especially his main fields of studies in the terms of Islamic, we can say, principles, usul al-fiqh, fiqh. We can say he was one of the students and one of maybe the best students, among the best students of Shahid Muhammad Baghir Assad. But Sayyid Mohsen Naghwi, regarding the political life and the political activities of Ayatollah Mahmud Hashimi Shahrudi, both in Iraq and Iran, there are so many documents. He was a political activist in both Iraq at the time of Baath regime and then in Iran. Talk a little bit about his political activities for us, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as we know that he was one of the most prominent and close students of Shahid Saad.
Definitely.
Since Shahid Saad has Hizbut Da'wah, which was against the Ba'ath regime, and they have these activities, Ayatollah Shahrudi was also involved in those activities from the very beginning. And but we can see, like, even in the history that in 1974, the Ba'ath regime, because of his activities that he had against the Ba'ath regime and the Saddam's regime, they imprisoned him, and he was in prison.
Right.
After that, we see that when the Islamic Revolution occurred in 1979, the first late Ahmad Khomeini was the link between the Imam Khomeini and Shahid Saad, and later it was Ayatollah Shahrudi,
okay.
Late Shahrudi, who was a link between them, and he used to, you know, bring the messages for Shahid Saad. And if I want to just quickly summarize the activities that he had in Iraq, after the martyrdom of Shahid Sadr, basically he became a prominent leader for the Iraqi, we can say, Shias, or those who were against the Ba'ath regime. And
at the time of Ba'ath regime, the Shias were banned from holding gatherings.
Yes.
So there were a great ulamas on that time in Hawza. Hawza was active on that time in Basra?
Hawza was active, and that was only for the educational cause. So they couldn't have the political, you know, speeches. Same was the case in Iran as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like at the time of the Shah Pahlavi, it was allowed for the scholars to have their lectures in the Hawza, but they were not allowed to talk about politics.
Okay.
You know, this was the secular thinking was within these... We can say the secular thinking was within these, you know, rulers of the time.
That's right.
And what made Imam Khomeini prominent from other scholars at the time of, before the revolution, it was that Imam Khomeini raised his voice against the things that were going on in the country.
That's right.
And he basically got involved in the politics of the country. Same is the case with the Shahid Sadr in Iraq.
Right.
Why Saddam killed Shahid Saad? Because he came and he basically started talking about the politics.
That's right.
And he was basically intervening in the political issues of that time for the weak, you know, people of the Iraqi, like the Iraqi people. And we can see the same activities that late Ayatollah Shahrudi followed the same footsteps of his teachers.
We get to Majlis A'la. you know, in Iraq by Ayatollah Hashemi Shahroudi, established by him, in fact. Dr. Fakhrani, brother, you yourself had many travels to Iraq, especially the cities of Najaf and Karbala. And we know that the Baas regime had such a pressure over there. They martyred so many members of the great families. It's called the families in Iraq, and banned so many others. Ayatollah Hashemi Shahroudi was among, we can say, those scholars who had to leave the country, Iraq, for Iran because of the Baas pressures over there. Talk a little bit about the political atmosphere of Iraq during the Baas regime and Saddam regime, and why Ayatollah Shahroudi left over there.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In order to discuss this point, it's necessary to go back and to refer to what our brother Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi has already referred to. We find that when shortly after the 1920 revolution in Iraq, we find that several dynasties, I mean Arab dynasties, came to power in Iraq, mainly in Baghdad. At first, a great majority of them had British leanings, and later on, with the upcoming of the ex-Soviet powers, we find that leftists and Marxists got to power. Okay, now we find that, apart from the Sunni populated areas of Iraq, when we come to the Shia parts, we find that leftists and especially communists, Marxists, wanted to propagate the teachings in the Shia populated areas. At this time, we find that among the great and renowned ulamas in Najaf, we find that the late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr was one of the most prodigious scholars who felt this threat and developed many books. And the back scenario of his writing the book Falsafatuna, or philosophy, was that the late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr wanted to highlight that the Islamic creedal system and the Islamic mindset is much superior to other frameworks already presented to people.
That's
as
right.
The savior of nations.
Okay.
At that time, because the ex-Baathist regime had apparently leftist inclinations and leanings, but in fact they were connected both to Americans and to Russians.
Okay.
And for the intelligence system, they benefited from the British and the Zionists at the same time.
Okay.
They benefited from everywhere who were against Islam. They felt the threat of the late Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, and not only the threat of the Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, but also the threat they felt from the close associates of the late Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
Including Ayatollah Shahroudi.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
We find that first they arrested and then martyred the late Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, and almost at the same time or shortly afterward, they wanted to follow up and to chase and pursue the close associates of the late Ayatollah Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. And it's because of this that the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahroudi first from Iraq went to Kuwait, and then from Kuwait he migrated back to Iran, okay, to his paternal homeland.
And were there any member of the family members of Ayatollah Shahroudi martyred in Iran?
There were three brothers.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
His three brothers,
wow.
They got martyred by the Baas regime, and they were involved in the political activities at that time.
Ayatollah Shahroudi's three brothers were martyred.
Yes.
Yes.
Wow.
And they were students in Baghdad, at the University of Baghdad.
One of them was a student, another had a business.
As a business?
Yes, had a business in Karbala.
Okay.
And there was another who was also, I think he also had a business, but they all three, because they were so much active in the riots against the Baas regime.
That's
and
right.
in the activities. So first they imprisoned them, and after them, obviously, they got martyred. And the interesting thing is that all three of them, the family has not received till today their dead bodies, and they don't know where they are.
Oh.
They were imprisoned by the Baas regime,
okay.
And where they took them, no one knows about them.
Yes, it was quite prevalent in Iraq at that time. Okay,
the killing of the scholars and the family members?
Killing and burning the body and so on.
Oh.
Or, for example, putting the whole body in acids, for example.
Oh.
Yes.
That's all right. So, you know, living under such circumstances in Iraq was really difficult, especially for scholars who could see, for example, that Islam talks about justice, Islam talks about the human rights and this and that, and then you'd have no chair or no place in order to express yourself, only the academic fields of studies. And was it based on the order or suggestion of Ayatollah Baghir al-Assad that Ayatollah Shardi left Iran?
No, basically it was after the martyrdom of Sheikh Sadr.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay.
And it was generally, he basically moved back to Iran, yes, before him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because in 1974 when he got imprisoned with the reference of a couple of like maraji of that time and the pressure of the ulama, he was freed by the Ba'as regime.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, obviously, I think it was Shahid Baghir al-Sadr as well, like who basically said to him to move to Iran.
That's right.
And that's how he became the link between the Shahid Sadr and Imam Khomeini.
And what was this Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, which was established by... Was he the main establisher of that?
He was one of the main people who was involved in establishing that.
Okay.
But actually, it was the Hakim family.
Mm-hmm.
And Shahid Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Hakim was the main person who was behind it. And they made this council against the Ba'ath regime, and it was obviously in today's world we can say at the moment we can say currently the most of the seats that were taken by a political we can say like group in the parliament of Iraq is from the same group. Although the Hakim family was the one who basically started this group, but we can see the first president of this group was late Ayatollah Shahroudi.
Mm-hmm.
And after 30 months, when he moved to Iran, then Sayyid Baqir al-Hakim took he became the chairman.
And
after him, his brother Abdul Aziz, and now it's Ammar al-Hakim.
That's right.
Who is the in charge of the group.
So and this majlis has specific roles. I mean, and that time especially.
Yeah, that time it was against the Ba'ath regime. Also, it has some charitable, we can say institutes.
Okay.
It is basically it's supporting the
That's
schools.
Right.
It has
That's
its
right.
own schools.
Okay.
There are the libraries mm-hmm. that they built because one of the reasons that there was a need of making. Such a majlis was because the Ba'ath regime wasn't thinking about the welfare of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And since they were not thinking about the welfare of people and they were just after governing and having their own rulership over the people, so people from inside who had pain for the Iraqi general public,
that's right.
Which is mostly from, like, it has come from the same ulama,
okay.
like the scholars in the Najaf and Karbala. So they raised their voice, they started these activities,
that's right.
and they started to develop the charitable institutes
mm-hmm.
to help the poor people. They started schools, because schools were not there, especially in the Shia, we can say, like, places where there were more Shias, they were oppressed by these Ba'ath regime, and they never wanted them to be become literate.
Okay.
So that that's one of the main things about the rulers, the cruel rulers, that they do not want people to get educated, because when they get educated, they can raise their voice against what's happening.
Okay.
So they want them to be illiterate, do not know about anything, and then mm-hmm. they can like rule
right.
the
that's
country.
Right. We know that in Iran, the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi was the head of the judiciary and the judicial system in Iran. And the new look that he had, I think, at the judicial power in Iran was absolutely based on the maktab of Shahid Assad. And, one of the great things that he had done was the change of the concept of imprisonment for the prisoners and the criminals in Iran, because he believed that, according to the Fiqh of Shia, this imprisoning itself has the negative consequences, influence on the soul and the spirit of the people. he tried as best as possible to replace it with the other, we can say, punishments. And the other great things that he had done, you know, regarding the new look that he had in the judicial system in Iran, started with Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi, and then the next generations of the head of the judiciary system continued that path. Thank you much. Dr. Fakhrouani, nothing to add, brother, to
no.
this field? Okay. And Zaid Mohsen Naghvi, thank you much, too, for being present in the program. The teacher, it was very kind of you. In three episodes, we tried to cover the character of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi. May Allah bless his soul. Because of a disease, you know, he passed away. The prayer on his body was led by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. And then his body was taken to the holy shrine of Hazrat Masuma in the holy city of Qom, and he was buried in Balasar Mosque in the vicinity of the shrine of Hazrat Masuma in the holy city of Qom. May Allah bless his soul. And we really missed him, and we could really benefit from him so much more. And unfortunately, he passed away because of a disease. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen and Dr. Fakhrouani, and thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. Do not forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islam, dini wal-ardu ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about ghusl, or the ritual bath, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, you know, sometimes we need to do ghusl either as an obligatory act or sometimes as a recommended one. But is it possible to actually wash our body with a soap or a shampoo while performing the ghusl?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, it is permissible to use shampoo or soap to wash your body and to make your to make your body pure. But of course, you can even use soap before making the niyyah of ghusl. You can wash yourself and use shampoo to wash your hair, and then your body. You can use soap to to clean your body. And then you can remove the soap and make niyyah of let's say ghusl, the ritual ablution, you know. And ghusl is something that has to do with your niyyah, okay? While washing your body, if you are not making niyyah of ghusl, it's not counted as ghusl. It's not considered ghusl, okay? The moment you make niyyah of ghusl, then your ghusl starts. You have to complete it, okay?
Right.
Yes, so if you want to use shampoo, first wash your head with shampoo and then make niyyah. Or maybe you can wash your head using water only, your head and neck. And then after washing and doing the ghusl of your head, because this is sequential ghusl, then you can use shampoo, to make your hair clean. And of course, either way is permissible.
I see. Both with it or without it?
Yes, of course.
All right. Okay. If someone forgets to do the ghusl janaba, and after a few days, then the same person remembers that he or she has not done it. And then what happens to this person? Does he have to, like, give the qaza of the prayers to offer?
Well, obviously, ghusl is mandatory. Ghusl means that one has to be in a state of ritual purity, and ritual purity is not achieved without without ghusl. But in the event that a person remembers that he has not done ghusl and he has performed prayers, of course, his prayers are not valid, and he has to repeat those prayers. But if he has done, like, if he has performed a mustahab ghusl, like, for example, ghusl, which is mustahab to be done on Friday, okay, which is called ghusl Jum'ah. If a person has done ghusl Jum'ah, for example, that is sufficient, okay? Or if
even if he didn't have the intention of the janaba there.
Yeah, even if he did not have the intention of ghusl janaba. For example, there are many mustahab ghusl that can be performed, okay? Those ghusl which are proved to be done, which are proved to be mustahab according to Islamic Sharia, okay, if a person performs any of those ghusl, okay, then that ghusl is sufficient for a ritual period.